Hello, insect friends. Are you ready for an hour of intellectual onanism? If so, extend your frail, jointed legs onto the web of the book spider, the all-seeing, all-knowing arachnid that sucks out textual fluids to grow bigger and bigger. I'm Patrick Barney, the most important member of your group of hosts, which also includes Chris Mollenberg and Hans Berger, each of whom has one fewer master's degree than I do. Today we're discussing Galatea 2.2, a heady and amusing novel by the famed Richard Powers. In it, a writer named Richard Powers returns to U, a Midwestern university, after the dissolution of an 11-year relationship with C, a woman Powers first met at U and with whom he moved to Boston and then E, a town in the Netherlands. Back at U, where Powers has obtained a position as humanist in residence at the Center, a fictionalized version of the Center for the Study of Advanced Sciences at the University of Illinois, Powers tries to complete a new novel, but he can't seem to get past the first sentence. That's okay, though, because in steps the abrasive engineer Philip Lentz, who wants Powers' help in winning a bet he has made with some colleagues. Lentz will construct an artificial neural network, and Powers will teach it how to pass a master's comp exam in literature. If the network can pass the exam, then Lentz and Powers win. After developing several implementations of the network that failed to sound even remotely human, Lentz and Powers create implementation H, which finally seems to be able to communicate with them. They call it Helen, and Powers begins to read canonical works of literature to it. As Helen develops, becoming more and more human-like, Powers becomes deeply attached, even reading his own novels to it. He begins to feel that, perhaps, it might have consciousness and emotions. However, before Helen can take the master's comp exam, a bomb threat gets called into the university, and Helen indicates afterward that it has suddenly become aware of its own mortality, the frailty of existence. It refuses to talk to Powers anymore. After a while, Powers does get Helen to talk again, but it does so only to offer one final goodbye before it apparently commits suicide. The grief that Powers experiences over Helen's demise acts as a catharsis for his failed relationship with C, who made it with another dude when Powers told her he didn't want to have kids. He is finally able to write again. Hopefully that sums up the important bits of the novel. So let's just get into it. So the thing I wanted to start with, we do this sometimes where we just kind of ask how you feel about the novel, but I wanted to ask that question this time specifically because, Hans, you said that you dislike Powers. So what are your guys' gut reactions to this novel?
I liked this one a fair amount. I like it a decent amount. I respect it quite a lot. My main experience with reading Powers before was The Echo Maker, which we all read for a class together probably 15 or so years ago now. And, Powers has this quality where his characters and sometimes like his narration, it's like about three times too clever. And it has this kind of quality of very self-conscious, very self-consciously smart cleverness to it in a way that just feels very mannered, very excessive, very self-satisfied.
That's so weird. That's exactly how I describe David Foster Wallace.
Well, and probably it's how somebody might describe a lot of authors that I like, actually.
Sure.
That's a totally reasonable critique of Wallace. There's something, it's totally subjective with Powers, right? Like there's some quality of the flavor of his work where just almost every author that I really treasure actually has a kind of like excessive self-satisfied cleverness to their work. But for some reason, it's like, I don't know. It's just, it's like olives, right? Like, I like most olive-ish flavors, but olives themselves disgust me. And most of the authors most of the authors, you know, like Thomas Pynchon is an onion and Richard Powers is an olive. And I love the Pynchon onion and I hate the Powers olive. And that's that's been my experience up until now, you know.
Wait, are you building that on some kind of like likeness of olives and onions? Like, I was thought you were going to be talking like briny pickled things, but then you're like, I tend to like olive like things, sort of like, you know, I like onions, but I don't like all. We can return to that.
You may be expecting a more complicated metaphor than I actually gave you, Chris. I don't want to get too far away from the question of how I felt about this novel, right? I mean, that's just all lead up to how I actually responded to this work. If that, not to kind of keep hogging the spotlight here, but like, I had that response to The Echo Maker where like the themes were really interesting, the plot was really interesting, but there was something about the sentence level writing that just had a flavor to it that always took me out of the experience of being in the work. And I tried reading Three Farmers at a Dance or Three Farmers on Their Way to a Dance. And I'm certain I read a sum of Goldbug Variations, so his first and third novels, and always hit that wall. But with this book, you know, maybe because I had to get through the whole thing circumstantially, the first 50 pages, I found that extra sense of cleverness incredibly unpleasant. And there were just little details about how the people talked and related to each other. And, you know, there's like a sequence where the abrasive engineer, Lintz, is making fun of the narrator for being too fond of Dutch and like does this kind of extended riff on the grammatical structure of Dutch. And I just thought, I can't fucking take 300 pages of this shit. You know?
Luckily, but you're saying that went away?
Either it went away or I stopped noticing it because there were other qualities that were, you know, more effective. I mean, I think like the relationships in the novel are very poignantly sketched. You know, the narrator's,
definitely,
the history of his marriage, or I don't think they're married, but the history of his relationship with C is very poignantly sketched with a lot of texture and nuance, and it's very poignant. There's an interlude where he has dinner with a woman named Helen who has a son who has Down syndrome and a, or not Helen, I'm sorry.
Diane.
I can't remember the, Diane, who has a son who has Down syndrome and another son who's probably autistic, maybe. It's not really defined as such, but you know, he just has dinner with this family, and it's very moving and feels very sensitive,
right,
and authentic. And I mean, like, the relationships are very, very well done, and that aspect of the novel really won me over once I kind of got through the initial irritant of kind of the style of it, which really a lot of that stuff felt most clumped in the first 50 pages anyway. And it's also, I don't know how much we'll talk about this, but like, I could be wrong about this. I'm not at all a technical person, but my sense is, you know, this is a novel published in 1995, presumably written a couple years before that. It's a novel published in 1995 about building a large language model on a neural network, which is, to the best of my limited technical ability, what he's doing here, what he's sketching out here, what he's describing here is uncannily similar to the structure behind something like ChatGPT.
Yeah, to my understanding, we have achieved what's happened in this novel.
So, I mean, I may be overstating this, I may be overselling this, but it really seems to me like this is about as prophetic a work of fiction as I think I've ever read. You know, I mean, people like to make a big deal about, for instance, Don DeLillo's ability to kind of seem like he's forecasting what will be important a couple of years down the road. And this, you know, what Powers has done here is really kind of pick up on the structure and nature of the actual first contact that we've had with real artificial intelligence. And that, to some extent, it's like so it's so uncanny in that regard, again, to a non-specialist. You know, maybe if somebody who actually worked on those systems were to read this, they'd feel differently. But to a non-specialist, it's so uncanny in that regard that it almost made it perversely, in a weird way, less interesting to read the novel. Because, like, on just the bits of, that are actually about the program, I was so preoccupied with thinking about how much of this seemed to resonate with how we've actually created functioning AI that it made it a bit harder for me, I think, to just kind of get into the flow of it as a novel, right? But it's certainly admirable. It's certainly interesting. It's certainly a notable achievement. So, yeah, I actually, the technical aspects of it I found fascinating for that reason, if not always, you know, easy to get into as a work of fiction, almost because they're too successful. And the interpersonal relationships I thought were very well sketched. And yeah, it's a really interesting, creative, cool, good novel. It did make me want to go back to some of his other stuff with a more sympathetic eye.
And what about you, Chris?
It's funny, Hans, that you went to olives and onions as much as I want to pull apart that metaphor. Because I actually was... I saw your question, Patrick, and I have a similar like issue with Powers, but I only read the Echo Maker, so I only had really the issue with the Echo Maker, but I still felt it, even though I did appreciate Galatea 2.2 quite a bit in the end. I still felt it here, and you'll forgive me. I'm not sure that this is a very good comparison, but it reminds me of why I don't find Ryan Reynolds funny, because Ryan Reynolds's humor is like kind of about almost like self-conscious about how funny I am at all moments. And it's not totally the you know, Han said some, you know, I tend to like, you know, olivey things, but I just don't like olives. Like Will Ferrell is that way. Like Will Ferrell is obviously like, you know, just a, you know, or Danny McBride, like, but for some reason, Ryan Reynolds is particular, like, sort of like, haha, I'm being funny, like, while I'm being funny quality just rubs me the wrong way. And there's something about how Powers is sort of like, look at how I manufacture wonder, or look at how clever I am. And I don't, you know, I'm right there with Hans. Like, I don't tend to like have a problem with a sincere appreciation of one's own abilities in their artwork. But for some reason, Powers is just kind of gets on my nerves. That said, I like Hans said it all, that the relationships feel a little bit more meaningful here than I remember them in the Echo Maker. And I think that there may be something to the fact that this, I feel like maybe if I knew his work better, maybe you would find Richard Powers in everything, like to more or less extent. I kind of remember, I didn't look this up. Like, I feel like Richard Powers maybe like, does he make like a minor appearance in the Echo Maker or something like that? But the fact that Richard Powers is kind of the protagonist of Galatea 2.2, the fictionalized version of Richard Powers, if for some reason I think that that works for me a little better.
I definitely didn't share your guys' reaction to Powers, and like I even kind of struggled to understand it. Like when I think of his prose, I do think clever, but I don't think clever in a like self-serving or you know, conceited type of way. I just think, wow, this guy knows how to put a sentence together. And if anything, you know, I want to preface this by saying that I have tried to read DeLillo and Pynchon with more sympathy after going deeper into their catalogs, but that would be my reaction to DeLillo and Pynchon. Like, these guys are self-consciously ironic and clever, and it's really grating and irritating. Whereas I just don't have that experience reading Powers. I just think, wow, this guy's solid and good. And I remember feeling like in that class that we took where we read The Echo Maker, I remember feeling like most people didn't like The Echo Maker but liked all the other works, and I really disliked all the other works but really liked The Echo Maker. And, you know, I don't know what that says, other than, you know, we're just different people with different experience.
And thinking about The Echo Maker now, I remember it with actually a fair amount of respect and maybe even a bit of fondness, but I know that I struggled with it at the time. Like, if I think about what the plot was doing, if I think about the idea of it, if I think about the imagery, it seems like a great novel, you know.
But you were saying, Chris, that the autobiographical aspects of the novel worked for you. You want to talk about that a little more?
Maybe it has to do with the weight that C casts over everything, and the dissolution of their relationship, and kind of it felt very sincere, and this is catching me. I think Richard Powers, the fictional character, is 36 in this novel, and I'm 36. And I haven't, you know, gone through what that character's gone through, and I'm not, I don't think, going through a kind of rebuilding my life phase. But it felt very sincere. I don't know if that is because it is autobiographically accurate, but it felt like it was written from a place, first, from a place of sincerity, and second, with a kind of a clever execution. Like, the sincerity felt like the foundation there, and I kind of, Hans, you know, and we should stop talking about The Echo Maker and start talking about this novel, in part because of what I'm about to say. I felt like the thing that we came to is that The Echo Maker was more fun to talk about than it was to read. And I think that this novel I expect it'll still be fun to talk about, and it was still moving to read. You know, I felt like the balance was a little bit more in favor of the experience of reading the novel here in this case. But yeah, I think that felt like, and I, you know, kind of going into your next question, it felt like the kind of backdrop of the failed relationship with C really did create some kind of meaningful canvas on which, like, the, you know, the current events in the story, the creation of H and Richard Powers' relationship with Helen, and his pretty embarrassing relationship with A. All of that felt really, really sincere first and clever second, and the cleverness was still pretty excellent. So it was enough for me.
So the autobiographical stuff for you gives the novel some sincerity, and that sincerity helps fill out or emphasize his relationship with H, or his relationship with Helen and with A.
And Diane. I think that Diane. Actually the it's interesting to me that two of them are known by letters of their names, and Diane and Helen have full names. There's little things like that. It feels like a Richard Powersy thing. And again, this is only the second novel that I've read of his that, not necessarily name play like that, but just playing with kind of, I don't know, symbology or how people sort of refer to each other in a way that it feels like it might indicate like a deeper pattern of meaning. I'm not sure what that means in this case, but yes, to answer your question, the sincerity anchored a lot of the play that Richard is doing with different themes and things.
when I think about it, like, now that you've put it that way, Chris, I do think, like, it helps me feel like when Helen goes silent, that, like, seeing like the dissolution of this relationship that Powers, the novel, the character has gone through, it makes me feel like his reaction to Helen kind of dying or going incognito or whatever you want to call it, that feels more sincere, more empathetic because of this past relationship. So yeah, I think that's a good connection.
I do wonder, and I don't know if there's any way to sound this out. I wasn't able to find it out on research, but I did keep wondering how accurate the autobiographical stuff was, just to the extent that, like, I mean, the novels that are described are clearly Powers' actual novels.
Yeah.
But did he actually have, did he move to the Netherlands? Did he have a relationship with a woman born in the Netherlands but living in the U.S., which, you know, crumbled around the time that he was writing Galatea 2.2? I mean, I, to some extent, that extratextual stuff is not really relevant, I suppose. But if our if one of the points that we're making is that the autobiographical aspect, the way in which it seems to be a way of working through personal experience, if that is something that we take as adding authenticity or an emotional center that kind of anchors a lot of the other stuff. If that's the case, then it's interesting. It's interesting that we don't actually know if the autobiographical stuff is made up or not, right? I mean, if clearly some of this is made up, and actually I think that the fuzziness of the boundary, it's interesting that we're responding to the fuzzy boundary as something that adds authenticity, when in fact he certainly must be to some extent lying about that stuff, right? I mean, some of it is in fact made up. So it's interesting that we're having a reaction of authenticity to something that is actually a matter of distorting real life. If that makes
right,
sense.
Right. Yeah.
That's
cool.
There's almost kind of a perversity to that in a way. And I mean, also kind of a privileging of quote unquote real or quote unquote non-fictional experience, that a privileging of those things that is something that I dislike, even though I'm not at all criticizing your point, Chris. I just think it's something that seems like an earnest and authentic technique that is in fact really quite almost inevitably has to be cynical in its use, right?
Well, let's think about this another way. So I kind of asked the question about autobiographical aspects just a little offhandedly, because to be honest, when I read this, I didn't really pay much attention to it. I just kind of was like, I don't know what's real and what's not, so I'm going to treat everything in my mind as if it's not real, like it's entirely fictionalized. And
that's probably the appropriate way to do it.
Right. That was what I was like. I was like, this is just all fiction. I don't care what's real. And I still thought this was a really interesting, engaging novel to read. So what happens if we do it that way? Like, do we lose the sense of authenticity that, like, the character of Powers experiences when Helen dies? Like, is that lost? What happens?
No. I mean, I think that, like, if I'm understanding your point correctly, Chris, and I guess I could just let you respond, but if I'm understanding your point correctly, Chris, like, your idea was that knowing the history of the relationship with C, makes it more poignant when Helen dies. Helen, the computer program, dies, because that gives us a grounding for what that really might mean to that character, and it makes it resonant in a way that it wouldn't be if there were no backstory and we just had his interactions with the computer to establish the relationship and the emotional stakes. And I think that certainly that's true whether or not we know that the literal Richard Powers
sure.
in the real world had a relationship pass away around that time.
Yeah, and I'm not super concerned whether the whether this is actually something that the author Richard Powers experienced. I was just suggesting that the, as I remember it, more explicitly fictionalized Echo Maker didn't contain the same convincing kind of relationship, like emotional sort of heft beneath like its interrogation of various sort of in that book medical psychological themes. And in this case, I mean, if it had been entirely fictionalized, it would have been fine. I think it would have had the same effect for me. And again, I should preface this. I've only read the two books. So it's, and I've only read the Echo Maker once. So I was just suggesting that Richard Powers writing really suggesting a kind of more sincere, suggesting a more autobiographical relationship between the story that he's telling about this fictionalized Richard Powers and his own life. Maybe that gave him an avenue to a more convincing emotional backdrop for me. You know, if the character was named somebody, you know, else, I still would have found it compelling. I'm more wondering if Richard Powers is, in trying to maybe tell a little bit of his own story, actually finding a more, for me, convincing human story than he would if he was telling just a completely fictionalized one, if that makes sense.
Yes, I think. I don't know. It's very complicated. It's very complicated because it exists in this unknowable space where it almost kind of becomes another thing where, so I was talking about the reading this in 2023 and knowing how prophetic it was about how artificial intelligence has actually arisen, at least a limited form of it. I think made it harder to just appreciate the novel as a novel than it would have been in 1995 when you could really just kind of enjoy the kind of play of ideas there, right? Like having to kind of, not having to, but I suppose choosing as a reader to kind of constantly fit the understanding I have of what's happening now to my sense of what's being described in the book. Like there's just an extra level of moving parts there that it creates reading this now that made everything a bit, that you know, dragged everything a bit, maybe not even in an unpleasurable way, but just added a kind of complexity to the reading process that slowed the momentum. And it's similar in a way to how the autobiographical aspect works, right? The kind of constant, like, wait, okay, I know that is his first novel. Is that the context for how he wrote his first novel? Like, knowing enough about his history to understand that some part of it is really taken from his life, but not knowing where the boundary is. It's another thing to kind of always be teasing the edges of, right? Trying to tease out the boundaries of. It's another point of confusion that just isn't really... It just kind of complicates what might otherwise have been a more seamless reading experience, maybe in an interesting way, maybe not in an interesting way. And probably, I mean, I assume that you guys, I'm guessing that you had less familiarity with his work, and so you weren't paying careful attention to the resonance between how the books are described and, you know, your knowledge of the actual first four books of Richard Powers, right? But it's like, it just, those two things actually kind of, the experience of how they added complexity in an ambiguously pleasurable way to the reading actually kind of was similar for me. Where if I had read this 10 years ago, and if I had read it without knowing his work well enough to understand the parts that are taken from life, it might have just been just kind of easier and smoother and more enjoyable.
So it does seem like the autobiographical aspects, it's not like you could have just written a straight novel without any like autobiographical allusions, and you still end up with a decent novel, but the autobiographical stuff does add some ambiguity and some other trajectories of meaning that might be worthwhile if we were to like tease them out and think about them. So it's not just bullshit, like, which is typically how I think of like stuff like this, like anything vaguely metafictional. I'm just like, it's just bullshit. I'm not going to worry about it.
It's not just game playing for its own sake, I think.
Right. Okay. So how about, this isn't a big or intricate question. I just really want to know why this novel is called Galatea 2.2. So for those not aware, our listeners, this novel, Galatea 2.2, is purported to be a retelling of the myth of Pygmalion. Pygmalion was a sculptor who carved a woman from a block of ivory, and then he falls in love with it, with the statue. Then later on, Pygmalion goes to Aphrodite's shrine or whatever and is praying, and he's like, give me a woman as beautiful as my statue. So Aphrodite brings the statue to life, and she and Pygmalion get it on and have kids and get married and yada, yada, yada. So, like, it makes sense that the novel would be called Galatea, with Helen being Galatea, right? Because, you know, this is the block of ivory, or the statue that's been carved out of this block of ivory. But why isn't it Galatea 2.0? Like, this is the second Galatea. So why 2.2? Do you guys have any idea?
I have to admit that I just assumed it was a matter of making it sound a bit more technically authentic somehow.
So just 2.0 is too bland, too not computery enough.
Yeah, it's bland and not computery enough, and 2.2 really just kind of drives home that this is a particular software implementation.
That's a good point about that. 2.0 can be kind of almost like a shorthand for just the second sort of big swing at something, you know, like the internet 2.0. It's not actually like an iteration of the internet, like it's not actually numbered. But sorry, Hans, that's a good point.
Yeah, and I mean, 1995, I might be, you know, I was 11, so I'm not a great authority on this, but I feel like there's a way in which computer terminology has kind of, there's a way in which computer terminology has saturated the language now that maybe it hadn't so much in 1995, like to where 2.0 might not have immediately registered to people as a reference to software numbering. I might be stretching a bit here, but in general, I feel like people wouldn't, I don't know, there's like a way that we're all used to things like software naming conventions, because like that the tech realm has taken over all of our society in a way that it just people didn't instinctively do then.
Right. Okay. Well, I think that makes sense. I really wanted it to be like, I don't know. I wonder, the title doesn't sit quite right with me, and I wonder if it would be just like, I get like 2.2 does like hearken to software better than 2.0, and you know, it probably did so better in 1995, and it still does so better in almost 30 years later in 2023. So I don't know. I wonder if I would just prefer it to be titled Galatea. Like,
is there a clear delineation in the arc of the story between two versions of what becomes Helen? Is there like a turning point where there's like one? Because, I mean, you know, technically, like, what letter is H in the alphabet? Like 11th, something like that?
Something like that.
So it should be called Galatea 2.11, right? Because
right.
they have A and then B and it ends on H.
Right.
So if anything, I mean, if there's like one, if you can track in the course of the novel one version and then another, I guess Galatea 1 was the literal Galatea, and then, you know, Helen is Galatea 2, and the second iteration, or the second big version is Galatea 2.2. I don't know. I don't think there's anything that we're missing. I assume it was kind of
right.
chosen for a sort of subconscious resonance, but maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah. Well, in that case, I'm just gonna maintain that just Galatea would be a better title, since 2.2 is too. It's not like titles like so. I know that I don't need to go on this big title thing, but. Have you guys ever read a story called I'm going to butcher the French pronunciation, La Haute by Camus? Have you guys read this story? It's sometimes translated as The Guest. Well, what's great about this title is that it involves the story involves a French man living in Algeria as a school teacher. Like he's way out in a remote desert region, and he's a school teacher to kids from the villages who live around there. And the story is about one night a Berber, a person who is indigenous to Algeria, comes in seeking shelter for the night. And so the teacher is like, sure, yeah, warm yourself by the fire, take a nap, whatever you need to do. And like gradually as they get to know each other, the Frenchman discovers that the Berber is on the run from some rival clan members who are out to kill him for revenge purposes. And this is all taking place within the context of French colonial settlement of Algeria. So the title is translated The Guest in English, referring to the Berber who comes to the house as a guest. Or is it referring to the Frenchman who is a guest in the in Algeria? And what's cool about the original title in French, La Haute, is that it can mean both guest and host. So it's got this awesome double meaning. And basically, I think every title should be as perfect as that title, is what I'm saying. And I don't think this title is as perfect as that title, unfortunately.
What does it mean about this novel, or our relationship to or response to this novel, that we've, to my reckoning, focused entirely on aesthetic effect and not at all on theme? That's almost unprecedented for us.
Oh yeah, it is. I don't know.
Is it because there's two threads here. There's the AI thread, and then there's the relationship thread, right?
Right.
And one of your questions was, how do those tie together thematically? And I'm really,
right.
for time's sake, because we're on a hard stop here, I'm drastically simplifying that, right? But like, thematically, how does the relationship stuff and the AI stuff tie together? Are those thematically related, or is the relationship stuff simply there to add emotional resonance to the AI stuff? I don't know. And it's the kind of novel where I have trouble sometimes telling if the novel is much smarter than me and doing something I'm not aware of, or if I am recognizing certain forms of its smartness and ascribing to it a deeper strategy and structure that I can't see, which perhaps may be illusory.
Well, I don't know either. And I don't think we're going to find out. At least not talking to one another right now.
Are we not talking? I mean, like you mentioned, like we're not getting into the themes of and like probably the kind of elephant in the room is AI, and we talked about how like this is a really resonant novel right now, and I don't know if I mentioned, I was just at a conference, Teaching with AI conference in Florida, like last weekend. And we were explicitly experimenting and playing with the ideas of actually like not trying to fight AI in education, but actually like embrace it, like just like teach people how to use it, encourage the use of it. What does that look like? And I think, you know, is it because you mentioned that how there's a kind of a cognitive dissonance with that, Hans, and maybe that makes that, because it is kind of so present right now, it doesn't feel like a fictional theme to kind of consider. It feels like a kind of a, almost a, something present right now that, like, you know, we're too close to really unpack anyway, and so it feels weird to try and unpack it in a podcast about a novel.
That's well, it may be that I'm wanting the novel to do more because of the moment that I'm reading it in, right? If I'd read this 10 years ago, the idea of somebody's relationship to a large language model would have been just kind of felt less momentous, right? Like, I think, like, right, because this novel was so prophetic about the nature of the program, I can't help wanting it to say something more significant about how we relate to this technology or what it means. And in fact, it's really much more, for all of its technical detail, it kind of ends up being sort of a love letter to aesthetics as much as anything, right? For all of its technical detail, it ends up being an extended romanticization of the beauty of language and poetry and writing. And, you know, that's kind of all there is to it. And Helen as a character only really, you know, three quarters of the novel is the lead up to her, right? She really only emerges at the end. And I think, again, because of the moment that I'm reading it in, I wanted a much deeper explanation, not exploration. I wanted a much deeper consideration of what Richard's relationship to Helen would be like as it developed, right? Or what, it's like it gets almost to the interesting point and then stops. But I think looking at it that way is the result of my sense of what the interesting point should be being distorted by the historical moment that I read it in. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. And I think that I bet you that there are novels out there that, in fact, I know that there are novels out there where what you're talking about, Hans, is explored. And this novel just doesn't do that. It's for all it purports to be about AI or a relationship with AI, it's more like about like you said, writing and poetry and our relationships with other people who are not artificial.
I should note here that I actually wrote, though did not publish, a novel in which an AI has a relationship with a woman and then kills itself. I believe that you've both read it.
I have, yes. And I remember thinking about it.
It's not a good novel. It's not a good novel. I don't mean to trumpet it in that regard.
I think there were certainly good aspects of it. It just needed more work, and then it could have been really good.
Years and years of work. But anyway.
Sometimes that's the truth. So I think that wraps it up. Let's hear from Chris about what's going to be next.
So this is one that was directly inspired by Galatea 2.2. I figure we continue on the theme of books that are trying to kind of have one foot in the future, which is actually the subtitle of the novel that I'm about to pick. Does anybody know what it is?
Not me.
Not me.
It's Rainbow's End by Werner Vinge.
Oh, okay.
Have either of you read that?
I know you've told me to read Vinge, and I know that he's on my list, but I haven't read anything by him.
He's more of a like a sci-fi, kind of a celebrated. He's like on the sci-fi side of literary sci-fi, but a kind of a William Gibson-ish like figure in science fiction. This one, I remember reading it when it first came out, and it was, I remember feeling unsettled by it and wondering if it was predicting something. And it's been 17 years since it came out. And so I'm curious, returning to it, if it does feel like it is predictive of the world that we're in now, or where we feel we're about to enter. So Rainbow's End by Werner Vinge. I remember liking it quite a bit. It's also about a writer with a problematic past, in this case, a poet with a problematic past at a school. So there's a lot of kind of overlaps.
All right.
But yeah.
All right.
I look forward to returning to it.
All right, listeners. I hope you've enjoyed our podcast on Galatea 2.2 by Richard Powers. Next time, it's going to be Rainbow's End by Werner Vinge. Peace out and keep it radical.